is already in the hearing. Ms. Jones, paragraph 1224. Dealing here with policy different outcomes. I just wondered whether the answer for the provisions to distinguish between the creation of empty lots where there's no land use consent granted at the same time and those lots created concurrently with a land use consent.
Sorry, I'm just not following what you're saying. Sorry. Is that on the same as usual? Okay. Sorry. Sorry, can you just ask me that again?
Sure.
So I'm talking about this policy, yeah.
I was just wondering whether the answer there is for the provisions to distinguish between the creation of empty lots with no land use, in other words, whatever the plan allows, and lots created concurrently with or subsequent to a land use consent for the development.
Like a unit title or subsequent developments.
Yeah, well, however it's done, the land use consent either occurs at the same time or concurrently, so the two are locked together.
Right, yeah, along the lines of the common mind was suggesting. Yeah, well, the way these rules work, from, as I understand, is if you are under that, if you are proposing lots under 380 square metres, then, and particularly the way we've amended them, you are required to introduce legal mechanisms to identify building platforms, etc., and design controls, whatever. So it's not an actual building design, but very close to it. Here's your building platform, here's your parameters, here's your allowable building envelope. As far as council would be concerned about this, it might be things in regard to your roof pitch or anything else they want to put in there.
What about if they did provide a building design? Would that satisfy them?
Yes, it would. And that's what happens in some others, is you get to choose between these five typologies.
I'm just wondering if the Bridesdale example.
Exactly what I was just thinking of.
Yeah.
Yes. So there's that option, but more cost up front for the developer.
I'm sure they pass it on.
Yes, exactly. And then it'll be cheaper in the long run.
Never know.
So yeah, that's certainly an option, and the next rundown from that is the quite prescriptive building controls that you're buying when you buy the title and all the enemies.
Paragraph 13.13, you're talking about building coverage and the like. Is it even necessary to have coverage limit? And aren't there requirements, or couldn't there be requirements as to minimum amounts of landscaping? And by the time you've got parking in, you automatically remove a whole lot of buildings anyway.
There's different ways of achieving it. You have a 30%, 20% open space and landscaped permeable surfaces, or whatever it might be, rule. And you're going to have 15% or whatever for your road in, and then 40% or whatever for your a certain amount for your car parking. I think the 60% is simple, and it probably achieves the same ends.
Paragraph 1340 on page 41. You say within the OSL, this is recreational buildings, there are controlled activity and thereafter may be a discretion. I just didn't grasp what you were saying there.
Yes, no, I'm not, sorry, I picked that up as well when I was reading it, but it didn't make sense. So essentially what I've done there in that rule is to say that a recreational building related to an outdoor recreational activity and no more than 4 metres in height, because that's what it currently is, would be controlled, and anything thereafter would be discretionary.
Right.
So if you were to do a much larger scale recreation activity that isn't anticipated.
In paragraph 16.6d on page 70, you say there more dwellings or multiple dwellings with a density of less than 380 square metres. Do you mean more intense than that density?
So this is just quoting what, trying to explain what's currently allowed in a notified PDP.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a handle on
that. Yeah, well, it's very confusing because it's always 380 and 550, so it's very recognizing that. So, yeah, and Jack's point, it's permitted to build a residential dwelling. If you're building either three or more dwellings, or dwellings with a density of less than 380.
Well, the density has to be something to something. Is that?
A density of less than 1 per 380 square metres.
That means that if you've got half a building for 380, so 760, that's what my question. Do you mean more intense than 1 to 380?
Well, a density of greater than
380. Yes, and maybe.
And sorry, then you've got sites less than. So yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, a density greater than 1 per 380.
Yeah, that's all I'm going to
clarify. Sorry, it was 750
square. I thought that's what you meant.
Yeah,
what you
so now you create 70, you've got 750 square meter site, you're going to put 2 houses on it. That's going to trigger a restrictive discretionary consent. Unless they've already been approved on sites less than 550 square meters through a subdivision consent. In which case they are permitted. So if you've already been through a subdivision consent and been allocated a building platform and all the rest, then you don't get triggered again
by
that rule.
Yeah. And again, I think it might be a similar thing. In paragraph 1645F, it's funny if you intend, you talk about building coverage should be lower for sites or more unit developments of a size or density less than 380 square metres. Is that the same? It should be. Coverage will be lower.
Yeah, I've kind of tried to try and achieve two things in the same sentence. So it's on sites Yeah, sites. Less than 380 or multi-unit developments of density greater than 380.
Just turning to your proposed chapter 41. Now, I take it you are not the author of chapter 41. I'll focus my questions then on the changes that you're proposing. In proposed policy 412117, you say you have in the middle of that policy proposing a range of activities including high density, medium density, residential housing, a small local shopping centre, etc. What does small mean?
Well, in this context, depending on where the rules end up, it would mean 9.9
hectares,
which is a very small
conundrum
we've got. We've got a policy.
Well, it takes us back to Commissioner Nixon's question earlier of Dr. Reid. We've got a population similar to the size of Braymouth. If you were doing a policy for a commercial centre in Braymouth, would you say a small amount of destination shopping?
I'll revisit that. We've got this conundrum between what we, and it appears all the experts are saying that they essentially are envisaging a small suburban, small town centre, small shopping centre, town centre, whatever, but actually the rules as they stand at the moment. I guess they enable that, but they don't
achieve it. When you just said a small neighbourhood centre, I was thinking three shops, a dairy, a takeaway, and something.
Yeah, well,
used to be a video
parlour, destination, and everything, but something along the lines of Harrowtown from the main street or something. But you're right, it's open to interpretation.
Just in Rule 41.4.3, the matters of discretion.
Sorry, what's that one?
41.4.3. In the matters of discretion, you recommended deleting any development controls and design guidelines. Given that the objective is all about design, does it not a matter of discretion?
Well, I guess two ways of reading it. My reading of that was that there were legal issues around having such a statement, and that there's no.
Well, there is on design guidelines.
Development controls or design guidelines that have been notified with the district plan or have any legal weight.
Is design an issue?
That's, I suppose you'd read that they are design guidelines proposed at the time of resource consent. And therefore, it would be appropriate to retain it. It would form part of the application. You could consider the appropriateness of the design guidelines.
Well, is it the design?
that's the issue.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, that's captured sort of under external appearance, visual landscape values, bulk and location.
Okay.
But I think it's a, yeah, I think it's a good point. So there are design guidelines that exist for the lodge, as I understand it, but they weren't, they're not, you know, not statutory as far as the district plan is concerned.
Yes. Now, in Rule 41.4.3.10, and the other thing is this should actually be 414313. That's misnumbered.
Oh yes. Sorry, that's the one
you're talking
about.
Yeah,
sorry, that's actually renumbered my one.
I was just uncertain that the words after all actually did what you thought they did. What is it?
Okay, good.
What is it you're trying to say there?
So what I'm trying to say is that they're not accompanied by a comprehensive development plan or alternatively are not in accordance with an approved comprehensive development plan.
Okay. And then the reference discretion is restricted to the matters listed in Rule 41439. There are no, that's actually a non-complying activity, that provision. So there's no matters of discretion listed. And that may be a number
right,
of.
Right, so that's, yeah, it should be 12 that I can now write a book
by. Right, okay.
Version will tidy that.
That clarifies that. This is on page 4120. 41555. And the problem arises earlier, not from your drafting, but from the original drafting, but it talks about the eastern of the three areas of lodge activity. It seems to me if we had more than one area of lodge activity, it would be sensible to identify the 1, 2, 3.
Yes.
Up to whatever, and then specify here because that rule is inherently unclear as to what it, where it applies. There is a series of other rules prior to that. Am I correct that Mr. Ferguson might be the person to ask about the original drafting?
Yes.
You might like to think about that before tomorrow. And in 41563, this is the provision that says, except as provided for through the approval of a traffic management plan by the NZTA, isn't that granting a discretion for a third party to determine the activity status of a road?
Mm. wondering if that all came from the submitter, and I'm just wondering if the traffic management plan you were talking about. Yeah, okay, so sorry there, yeah, about construction. I'm not sure of the legalities of that. I think we need to the law stands except for construction purposes where a traffic management plan has been approved or something, but whether that expires or not.
No, that didn't apply. And now, in building height ones, 41.5.12.2, I just want to be clear, I think I know what you mean. Is the intention in the Homestead Bay village area that there be a 10 metre height limit but no more than two stories in the circumstances where the ground floor is commercial?
Yes.
If the ground floor is residential, it doesn't matter. Right.
Now, I guess the implication that would be that then if you've done a three-storey terrace house, you shouldn't have any expectation that you would then come and convert that to commercial later on.
Right, three units, yes, you might do.
That would breach that one, but yeah.
And then it's on page 4126, but it's actually in rule 415.1. The discretion is restricted to the following, and the second bullet point we have and the character of the activity area. What? How does a consent planner apply that? I'm happy for you to think about it.
Yeah,
for the reply.
I know where it's come from and what the submitter's concerns are.
Okay.
But yeah.
Any questions arising?
I've two things related to the objectives and policies. One of them here, it's just a choice of words and whether I've got scope to make the changes or not. First one is 41.2.1.17. And in view of the suggestion that we, I know there's going to be a small commercial area at Homestead Bay, but it says enable the Jack's Point village activity to develop as a vibrant mixed use hub, and I presume we should be saying D to make it absolutely clear that that is the hub. So ending up with a clever, dare I say, lawyer coming on later on, part of the client saying, well, that's just one side. The other one here is just the wording, I suppose, that draw up objectives and policies on performance as a trap. 41.2.1.3 talks there about maintain and protect views into the site with view from the lake. I presume we're really talking, what's really aiming to do there is maintain retain the natural appearance of the site as viewed from the lake rather than views into the site, which we don't do anyway. And the second part of it talks about protect views across the site to the mountain peaks beyond. Well, you have extensive development and you're still going to see the mountain peaks beyond, and I suspect what it's really trying to say is to ensure that views of the mountain peaks beyond are not dominated by residential development in the foreground. So whether there's some ability to sort of make them say what they mean is something I'd love to think about. Again, just thinking about it in terms of years to come, when somebody comes along with a development proposal, people like Jack's Point companies and Lonsdale's disappeared off the scene, that kind of thing. And people can intimately focus on objectives and policies, see how it might or might not help their argument.
Yeah,
Because at the moment that's rather loose.
I had a note that somebody asked whether there was scope for Dr. Reid to make suggest changes to
yes,
the policy.
Yes.
I don't know whether I get that wrong.
I asked that question.
To you?
Yes.
Yes. Did you want me to respond to that? Or?
If you're able to, yes.
So, my take on it is that changing it from views from the state highway to public places beyond the Jack's Point zone. Come from a concern of hers in relation to the addition of various home sites and so on, and wanting to cast that net more widely in terms of visibility. And I'd suggest that the scope comes from those that have submitted against the FP1 and FP2 areas and all the other, and EIC, all the areas indirectly, they just wanted the open space areas to stay as they are in the operative district plan. And so, if you think about, we're now looking at recommending that we enable some development in those more sensitive areas. And then this policy looks to try and add a layer of, add some clarity or some direction around that. So that's where the scope from. That's where
Sarah
comes from to make that change.
I wonder if Dr. Reid's evidence was so narrow, because she started off by suggesting that the road and the lake were too limited an area to consider, but not to be considered on, for instance, the foreshore in Queenstown and the effects overall of development in total in that area.
Yeah.
And that, for me, as public places beyond the Jack's Point zone, would include those areas.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And is that focused just on that issue of further development of the open space?
Well, no, I suppose the policy gets cast more widely than that, applied more widely.
Mm. Might want to look at that more carefully, but to be honest.
Primary submissions were received on Chapter 42. The submission from Ayrburn Farm Estate Limited, which seeks that additional land was rezoned Waterfall Park Zone, has been deferred to the hearing on mapping and rezoning requests in the Hawkesbury Basin along with the associated deferred submissions. The submission by Mr. Kane Brown supports the notified chapter, and I recommend that this submission is accepted, subject to recommending a number of minor changes to improve readability and ensure consistency in formatting and style of the rest of the PT. These changes are non-substantive and do not rely on any particular submission for scope. Following filing of the Section 42A report, I have noticed that an amendment is required in the subdivision chapter as there is a gap in the law framework. Rule 27.712 needs to be amended so that it applies to the Waterfall Park Zone as well as the Millbrook Resort Zone, so that subdivision that is inconsistent with the Waterfall Zone structure plan is a discretionary activity. This approach is consistent with the activity status of such subdivision in the Millbrook Resort Zone and Jack's Point Zone. The recommended amendment is shown using perfectives as follows. Just to answer your question.
That doesn't look to me like a non-substantive change.
Just to respond to your earlier question from Ms. Scott, subdivision in the resort zones in the operative district plan is controlled. You did ask that question earlier today.
But that doesn't matter.
No.
That the change from the notified plan, if
the landowner, as I understand it, lodged no submissions, they're obviously happy with the rules.
The notified district plan. Yeah, I'll need to look, sorry, because I thought the question earlier today was about the Auckland district plan. And the notified PDP, subdivision was at least restricted discretionary, but if it hasn't been mentioned, I'll need to look, because this has probably come about through the right of reply version, which introduces the productivity status if it's consistent with...
Yes, if it was generally, if it was caught by the general... Everything is restrictive discretion.
So that may...
Is it restrictive or that was full discretion?
Well, yeah, I'm just thinking, I haven't got the full subdivision check.
It might just be useful if you could just enumerate that change for us, because I think we're going to go back through several hearing screens now, but as notified, yes, all subdivision was discretion.
Yeah,
or restrictive discretion.
That's correct. It'll be just...
Of some sort was required.
Yeah, I'm sure it would
have been discretion. And it had some element of discretion, then that, of course, could be in here because that inherently is no change from what was notified.
Mm.
And
yes.
Yeah, so I think it just needs to be set out for us exactly what that was so that we can be sure that we're not removing anyone's rights.
Well, certainly, we can do that in our reply, and apologies.
Do you have any questions?
No, I've got no questions.
No, thank you, Ms. Jones.
Thank you. That brings us now to the Millbrook Zone. Millbrook Resort Zone. We have Ms. Hannah Ennis, who
Can I just ask Mr. Chair, because I've got no interest in the Millbrook Zone for this hearing, should I stay for the end? Is there anything else here? Anything else you want to talk about just tomorrow? You can speak to see.
I think I've given you enough.
Yes, because thank you for the two. I just thought I'd check before I disappear.
No, that's fine. We'll see you at night.
Great, thank you very much.
Yes, when you're ready.
I am Hannah Ennis. I've been engaged by Queenstown Access District Council to provide landscape evidence on Chapter 43, Millbrook Resort Zone proposed district plan. In general, I agree with the proposed rezoning of the Dalgleish Farm site to become part of the Millbrook Resort Zone, subject to some minor amendments to the PDP provisions. In my evidence, I provide a comprehensive review of the documentation that is available in relation to the landscape matters regarding the MRZ, Millbrook Resort Zone, and in particular the Dalgleish Farm extension. Aside from a few discrepancies, my opinions were generally consistent with those outlined in that documentation, including in particular the previous landscape assessment and addendum provided by Baxter Design Group. I subsequently reviewed the evidence of Andrew Craig, which was filed on behalf of the Millbrook Country Club, Millbrook. I find this evidence to be a more detailed and well-justified assessment of the landscape and visual effects of the proposed rezoning compared to Better Test Landscape Assessment and Addendum. appended to Mr. Craig's evidence are several new visual simulations from key public viewpoints. These are useful in satisfying my apprehensions with regard to the potential level of cumulative effects and visual effects relating to the double edge farm extension. Overall, Mr. Craig's evidence has in most cases reiterated and in some cases altered the opinions set out by evidence, which I highlight below. A, the road sign planting overlay. First of all, I'd just like to clarify it was never the intention of the suggested overlay to encourage a linear shelter belt type tree planting. The shape I've drawn encompasses existing roadside tree planting and it just happens to be linear in its form. I'm open to Mr. Craig's suggestion that a rule or notation on the structure plan may be sufficient instead of an additional overlay, so long as the rule is worded in a way that it ensures the intentions, the original intentions of that overlay. B, building design on the upper slopes. I acknowledge Mr. Craig's argument against altering the roof lines to better reflect the landfall, as I had suggested. Based on Mr. Craig's visual simulation provided from the Maligans Road viewpoint, I now consider that both houses visible in that view shaft will have a negligible adverse visual effect once proposed vegetation matures. I'm now more comfortable that if Millbrook agrees to form a rule around retaining and or replacing the existing trees along the roadside, this will provide sufficient visual softening of the Dalish farm site to render any visibility of steeply pitched roofs on the upper slopes acceptable. That said, I still remain of the opinion that the architectural form of buildings and associated landscaping could better suit the landscape character of the upper slopes than what is anticipated under the current Millbrook design guidelines, which do not specifically address the double edge farm component and thus suits the landscape character of the flat pastoral land. And C, plant species lists for planting overlays. I maintain the opinion, and Mr. Craig agrees, that the plant species list should form part of the Millbrook design guidelines rather than being listed in the rules. I believe that Millbrook's revised package attached to Mr. John Edmonds' evidence with some further modification is effective in addressing the landscape-related concerns of most submitters. The only exceptions being submitter Skip Williamson, who raises concerns about the activity status of utility and farm buildings in the landscape protection activity areas, and Louise Taylor, who is X-ray trust planner, who has provided evidence on the location of performance standards for buildings and the enforceability of the Millbrook design guidelines. In my statement of evidence, I agree in part with Skip Williamson that greater controls should be maintained over buildings and landscape protection areas. In his evidence, Mr. Edmonds discusses the provision of utility buildings in the landscape protection area as permitted activities. While I acknowledge the requirement of utility buildings for the operation of the golf course, I'm still not convinced that utility buildings up to 25 square metres should be a permitted activity in the landscape protection area. I suggest a stricter activity status or more specific controls on utility buildings. I agree with Ms. Taylor's evidence of X-ray Trust, where she recommends the performance standards for buildings regarding height and precession planes remain in the rules rather than being shifted into the design guidelines. At this stage, I do not agree with Mr. Edmonds, who suggested removing reference to the local design guideline and his amended set of plan provisions. These guidelines, which need to be amended to take into account the double edge farm component of the zone, will contain a layer of detail that would just not be suitable to be written as rules. And this detail will play a critical role in ensuring buildings and associated landscaping maintains a high level of visual amenity. I would like to hear further clarification from Millbrook's experts on their reasoning before forming an opinion with regard to this.
Just on that point of design guidelines, in paragraph 16 of your evidence, you refer to them.
Okay.
Thank you. Now, Is it your view that appropriate development is dependent upon the application of the zoning guidelines?
Yes, it is. I think that it's been right from the beginning of talking about the appropriateness of the site to absorb development. It's been agreed upon by multiple different landscape architects that the visual amenity of the site is still very important. And I believe that the design guidelines really guide into the appearance of the buildings and landscaping in this area. So.
Yes, question about the planting overlay, and I'm assuming that just applies along the Dalgleish section we're talking about here, isn't it?
Correct.
The rest of it. When I read your evidence, I did assume it was unlikely to be a linear shelter belt. I know along parts of Malahans Road you've got those old hawthorn hedges that go for miles, but they don't extend along this frontage, do they?
No, this frontage is, from what I recall, it's mainly some mature, I think they might be alders or poplars. So they're not of any sort of native protection status or anything, but they do provide a level of, I won't say screening because they're filtering views of the site.
Yeah.
But certainly, when there are openings in them, they do frame views of the double H arm site. So yeah. You notice when they're gone.
Yeah. So I think aligns to what both you and Mr. Craig are really saying is that that's not blocking visibility, but you've not got prolonged periods where you're looking straight at the site without anything.
That's
right. So I guess it comes down to the proofs of the pudding, really, in terms of what kind of, if it's not an overlay or shown on a plan, structure plan, is what kind of rule you have to make that workable. So I assume that's something that is evident to be looking at.
That's right, and I believe Ms. Evans and Mr. Edmonds have been in a discussion about how best to write that rule in order to make it effective for what we're trying to achieve. And,
Now the other thing that was touched on by the chairman is the design guidelines. Now, my understanding was that if you sort of go to a halfway house, like this, the design guidelines include, they could go to as far as things like height or that kind of fairly major type of things, right down to details of colours of buildings or the type of surface materials. I think it was being suggested that a halfway house would be best, that it would be appropriate to have standards for certain things and the rest be left in the guideline. So are you comfortable with that?
That's right. I am, and actually just discussions that I've been having just in the last sort of, even this morning and last night, following the meeting that Ruth has had, I am comfortable that a lot of that does fall into the rules, but I still think that there is some, we do need to just tweak the wording of those rules, particularly to do with the colour of the buildings and things like that, which are really important. And I know in the current Millbrook design guidelines, they've actually specified the regime colour that the buildings can be, whereas in these rules, they say they're referring to colours that have no more than a 30% light reflectivity value. But I would just like to see some more specifics around that, because I guess what was sort of promised was that they would be much more dark and recessive colours up on the upper slopes in particular. And I think whilst they may not be so important from views from Malagans Road, I think they're really important from distant views to make sure that we are getting a lot darker colours up there. So it really comes down to how we're reading those rules.
Okay, thank you.
I think everyone agrees this is not an outstanding natural landscape.
Yes.
Should we be careful to not over control in a way
that we would if it wasn't a thinly natural landscape. I mean, I raise this because the tendency in ONLs is to make houses invisible or disappear. And yes. It seemed to me that the answers that you were giving to Commissioner Nixon, you were saying, well, these houses should disappear or not be visible. Is that necessarily appropriate?
It was definitely, what's being proposed obviously would never get through in a rural zone, but we're talking about now changing this to a resort zone. We've come to the conclusion that a resort zone is...
If you go through a lot of the resource consents that have been granted in the Waterbury Basin, a lot of things have been allowed in the rural zone.
This is true, but I guess the density that we're talking about has,
So you see it as a concept that the density is what means that we need to be more careful. Is that what is triggering it?
The density is actually not as visible, particularly on the upper slopes. It's not as visible from the closer viewpoints, but from more distant viewpoints, you can see that this is an extension of a resort. And I guess if that were to continue, there could be potential for cumulative effect. Although in this case, I feel comfortable that there is enough topographic constraints to ensure that this pattern of development doesn't necessarily just keep spreading. I think if it did, that would start to have an effect in that wider view.
Okay. Anyway, to assist us, where is the walking track up Fairley Hill? Where does that start from?
I'm not very good with the map of Arrowtown.
Is it in the city street?
Yes. I actually haven't been to the top of Fairley Hill.
Oh, I see. So you're not the right person to ask.
No, I've been going off visual simulations.
Right. Okay. No, that's okay. Well, I'll check with Mr. Craig.
Mr. Craig has the first attachment of the review.
Yes.
That shows a view from the top of Fairley Hill.
Yes. Yeah. And there's been a few other, and the photo simulations from various types of architects have been panoramas from there.
Yeah. Thank you very much for seeing us.
That leaves us, Mr. Chair, with Mr. Stevens.
Yes.
I think we're doing well.
Direction and general intent of the notified chapter 43 Millbrook resort zone provisions should remain largely unchanged. I also recommend a number of changes aimed at improving the effectiveness and or efficiency of the chapter. The provisions, as recommended in my section 42A report and as further recommended to be changed in this evidence summary, are considered to be effective and efficient and an appropriate means of achieving the Resource Management Act and the strategic direction of the proposed district plan. The key issue is the expanded area of the Melbourne Resort Zone over the Dalgleish Farm. The majority of the substantive amendments reflect the agreed position reached between Melbourne Crown Country Club and X-Ray Trust. The exception appears to be how the chapter references to design guidelines and whether some details should sit within the non-statutory design guidelines and or standards or within the zone provisions. On Monday, 13th of February, I caucused with the planners for these two submitters and outlined the agreed position made in the summary at a high level. The detail will be provided in my reply amendments. Recommended amendments outlined in my section 42A report included an updated structure plan that provides for improved mitigation of adverse effects beyond the Millbrook Resort Zone, introduction of more specific overlays to manage planting, earthworks and building restrictions, introduction of indicative residential sites in R15 and R16 residential activity areas and associated controls, a rule requiring amended design guidelines and compliance plans be submitted to the council to cover the Dalgleish farm for approval prior to development proceeding. I've now changed my position on this, as explained below. A rule requiring development to proceed in general accordance with the structure plan and design guidelines. And again, I have changed my position on this, which I'll explain. And then some non-substantive amendments to policies and rules to improve clarity, consistency and effectiveness. In line with the evidence filed on behalf of Melbourne Country Club and X-Ray Trust, and without prejudice focusing with other plans, with their planners, I have reconsidered some of the matters and now recommend some additional changes. I have now recommended that all references to design guidance within the chapter are deleted. I agree to include in the rules the site-specific height above sea level and recession plan controls agreed to between Melbourne Country Club and X-Ray Trust. I had initially recommended that these bespoke provisions sit in the guidelines. However, I agree with submitters that these controls should be located in the chapter to remove uncertainty or discretion of their application. The remaining outstanding matters to be addressed are the landscaping species and building colours and materials. In his evidence, Mr. Evans provided for building colours and materials in Rule 43.4.17 with landscaping species in an appendix. Consequently removed any reference to the guidelines in the chapter. While ordinarily my preference is for more fine-grained matters such as cladding and plant species to sit outside the plan or be dealt with as conditions of consent, I acknowledge that Millbrook is a special zone and therefore some more bespoke rules may be expected within the chapter. Given that these two issues would now be the only matters required in the updated guideline, I consider the inclusion of a rule in an appendix to be more efficient. This also provides more certainty for proposed district plan users compared to having to also refer to a guideline for these two matters. I therefore recommend reference to the guidelines and any rule requiring their preparation to be deleted from the chapter, and building materials and colours, landscaping species to be contained within the chapter as a standard or appendix, creating a one-stop shop for plan users. This will also require colours and materials to be specified for R13, 17 and 18. Although having discussed with Ms. Ayres earlier, there's a question mark over whether they're required for R13. With regard to the proposed rule requiring the design guidance to be submitted and approved prior to development proceeding, redrafted Rule 43.4.26, and the rule requiring development to proceed in accordance with the guidelines, as it provides Rule 43.4.27, these would no longer be required. With regard to revised Rule 43.4.27, I recommend that the reference to council-approved design guidelines be removed and the activity status changed to discretionary. This is consistent with the rule in the subdivision chapter that requires development to proceed in accordance with the structure plan and has a discretionary activity status. Mr. Edmonds from Millbrook Country Club has provided an updated Chapter 43 with his evidence. My further comments on Mr. Edmonds' evidence and revised chapter are as follows. In paragraph 37, Mr. Edmonds states that in Section 42A, the height for R14 has been reduced and there is an additional exception for R15. This is incorrect. The height for R14 and exceptions for R15 and R16 remain the same in the notified in Section 42A versions of the chapter. From my check of these details, I note that the height for R14 was changed to 6.5 metres in Millbrook's revised, I think the 2nd of December, version, but this had not been shown as a track change. Similarly, the height overlay exception for R16, not R15, has been removed from Millbrook's revised 2nd of December version, but not shown as a track change. These changes have been carried through into the Millbrook updated chapter. At the time of filing the summary, I understand that Millbrook and X-Ray Trust planners were conferring with their landscape architects to determine what height was utilised in visual assessments, and I think also in the visual simulation. Mr. Edmonds has also suggested the deletion of some rules, for example, notified rules 43.5.10, 43.5.12 and 43.5.13, where I do not consider there is scope to do so. Regarding the merits of the deletion of these rules, with respect to 43.5.10, which is in relation to water firefighting, I've sought advice from Council's development engineer, who considers the rule should be retained as fire hydrants need to be installed in accordance with code of practice, which applies to all firefighting for both reticulated and non-reticulated supplies. And I just note, in relation to that, I'm seeking further advice from the development engineers, because I understand it to be an uncommon rule in the postman.
Advised that the fire service have sort of similar rule in almost every other zone that I've heard so far.
Okay.
On the PDP.
Right.
They probably didn't submit on this zone because it was over there.
Okay. Noted. With respect to rule 43.5.12, I agree that air emissions are a regional plan matter, although I note the focus of this rule appears to be with regard to amenity, and is directly linked to policy 43.4.25. If the panel were in review to delete the rule, then I consider that the policy should also be deleted. With regard to rule 43.5.13 regarding helicopter landing areas, I consider this should be retained to control the number of helicopter landing areas in the zone, but that the words approved by resource consent should be deleted. I agree with Mr. Edmonds' suggested amendment to the proposed roadside planting overlay. However, I consider the proposed rule also needs to require trees to be replaced if they become diseased or die, as recommended by Mr. Edmonds. This could be achieved by adding retention and long-term replacement when required of those trees within the landscape protection of Maligan activity area to the end of Mr. Edmonds' proposed rule 43.4.5. And I do understand that Ms. Ayers still has concerns about the wording of a number of rules, including control of farm, accessory and utility buildings in the Millbrook updated chapter, which is just briefed on.
Okay. Starting off at the end, I suppose. 11, on your last page, 11E. Mr. Edmonds suggested the proposed roadside planting overlay. Now, maybe confusing two things here, but from listening to Ms. Ayers' evidence, Mr. Craig indicated he didn't think there was a case for an overlay and it would be better to have a rule.
That's right.
Is the conclusion reached on that?
So I think the conclusion that we reached was that there would be, instead of introducing a new overlay, we would use the landscape protection Maligan activity area, which is a new activity area, and then the rule requiring consent if you remove trees relates directly to that, and that's Mr. Evans' version.
So the basic gist of the rule would be if existing trees are removed, you've got to replace them. That's basically it. So,
that's right.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. The other question raised was just probably a more general one again, and it comes up, it came up with Jack's point, and that's the structure plan, which again is very, it's very difficult to find out where anything is because you've got little sort of amoebas floating around, which are development areas like R13, R12, whatever it might happen to be. Now there's an existing roading pattern in there with the existing part of the Millbrook. Malahan's Road is not shown, but it's obvious physical feature which is not going anywhere. Waterfall Park is an adjoining neighbour that could be shown, for example. I'm just wondering, even with that Dalgleish area, presumably there would be some kind of indicative roading pattern, which doesn't need to be linked to a rule, but by tying it to some kind of physical features, it would make it a lot easier for people to find things. So I just exhort the council to consider that when they finalise the structure plan.
Okay, that makes sense.
Because the television leader.
Good. don't know New Zealand's whether you or Ms. Scott can answer this, but I presume you did not hear the notified chapter. You didn't? No. And I presume that if I had questions about the notified chapter, I'd be best to ask Mr. Edmonds those questions. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Right. It's okay. He's in the back. He can phone up overnight. I will strip my questions, Ms. Edmonds, to you, to anything that I have on what you would recommend to be changed. So, noting that you've deleted all comments about design guidelines, it probably doesn't leave me with anything. Yes, it does. In rule 43.4.13, we've got the bullet point. Well, actually, it won't be a bullet point by the time you read the first part, but it says one farm building relocated from within the site. Do you mean the site or the zone?
The zone.
Is that an activity or a standard?
Thank you.
And in that case, we'll adjourn till 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.